gotta change it. When I have to change it now, I have to get changed. I'm doing it now. I'm gonna do it today.
Any questions about anything? Oh, I keep looking at chapter 5 and thinking I ought to do a couple of things that Stein did. Polish up, and especially when it comes to solving the heat problem, now that we know some things about the Fourier transform, we can say that the things I played around with back when I was showing you what the Fourier transform was good for, now I can demonstrate that that technique actually spits out something useful. So the heat problem that we worked on back then was the hot wire problem, and the Fourier transform was the most useful when the heat problem was on the whole infinite line wire. So this is the hot wire problem, and it's an infinite long wire. So the whole real line is a hot wire. And so the temperature in the hot wire satisfies the heat equation, and subject to the boundary condition, we know the temperature at time zero. And today we're going to, now that we know more about Fourier transform, we're going to assume that this initial temperature function is in the Schwarz class. And that's a reasonable assumption because when you think about the universe, it's stone cold far away. So, it's conceivable. If we're going to study a problem like this, it makes sense that the temperature would die away rapidly as you go out into outer space. So the technique was to take the Fourier transform in the space variable. So we define this u hat of st, so time just floats along like a parameter, and we took the Fourier transform in the space variable. E to the minus 2 pi I x s dx. And now that we know more, when f is in the Schwarz class, taking the Fourier transform keeps you in the Schwarz class. So it's a safe bet that maybe this u is going to be in the Schwarz class in the x variable. We're going to see that when we're done. But when I take the Fourier transform in the space variable, then you realize, aha, if I were to take du hat dt, if everything's in the Schwarz class, I should be able to differentiate under the integral sign. And so I would get an integral from minus infinity to infinity of du dt xt e to the minus 2 pi I xs dx. And that's the Fourier transform of du dt. So when I hit the heat equation with the Fourier transform, also I'll do it like this. Take the Fourier transform in the space variable of d2u dt squared. That's going to be the Fourier transform in the space variable of du dt. And we just saw that that's du hat dt. Oops, this is an x squared right there. And one of the standard properties we learned about the Fourier transform is that when you apply the Fourier transform to a derivative, it spits out multiplication by, 2 pi I. So let's see, we differentiate once, we get 2 pi I S. Times the transform. And if we differentiate again, we get another 2 pi I coming out. So 4 pi squared times minus 1. Let's see, another S would come out too. So I'd get another 2 pi I S. And so when I'm all done, I get minus 4 pi squared s squared u hat of st equals d by dt of u hat of st. Okay, at first I was letting t float along as a parameter, but now I've got a very easy differential equation in terms of t. This is like exponential decay. Du hat dt is minus something times u. That's the exponential decay problem that you solved in freshman calculus. And you get u hat of st is e to the minus 4 pi squared s squared times a constant. I wanted my constant here, sorry. And for different values of s, I might get a different constant. So that constant depends on s. So for each fixed s, I solve that problem in t, and I might have a different constant in s. And sure enough, you can verify that that function solves that differential equation. And then finally, we can actually figure out what the cs is by plugging in time equals 0. Then you would get that u hat s at 0 is the cs. And when you write out what u hat s of 0 is, that's integral from minus infinity to infinity of f of x that's when u is supposed to be f of x. So this would be f of x times minus 2 pi I sx dx. And that's the Fourier transform of f. So we see that the constant, that function that pops out in front, is actually the Fourier transform of our data. And so what we finally have is that u hat of st is f hat of s times e to the minus 4 pi squared s squared t. And the last thing we did then is to undo the Fourier transform and get, so we do the Fourier inversion formula. And see that u of xt would be the inverse Fourier transform of this thing, which is the minus integral from minus infinity f hat of s e to the minus 4 pi squared s squared t e to the plus 2 pi I s x ds. Okay, now that we've got this, and now that we know more, this, since f was in the Schwarz class, f hat is in the Schwarz class. And that means that this is a really nice function. And you can differentiate it under the integral sign blindly. So now that we know more, we look at this part and say, aha, This solves the heat equation. If I take the second derivative in the
in the S variable. Let's see, where's the...
Do you have a T where there's an X there?
F hat, e to the minus. That's my function of S, and I want to undo the Fourier transform. That's right. Yeah, this function satisfies the heat equation in x and t.
This satisfies the heat equation in x and t. And this is a Schwarz function, because f was in the Schwarz class.
So it means if I wanted to mess around and differentiate under this integral sign, you can read it in Stein. I take the tail end of the integral, which goes to zero really fast, and I can chuck it. And then, because I have real nice uniform convergence on a finite interval, I can differentiate under this integral as many times as I want and see that u of xt is infinitely differentiable and it satisfies the heat equation.
So here's what today's news is about. U of xt, so I can differentiate under that integral as much as I want. Because of the Schwarz function, and what I see is that u is infinitely differentiable. I see that u is infinitely differentiable in x and t, r plus actually,
which is neat. And it satisfies
the heat equation. Because when I differentiate and take the operator underneath the integral, you get zero because the kernel satisfies the heat equation.
So the last thing to check is, in what sense does it satisfy the boundary conditions? And that's where we know something we didn't know before. So let's see. Now that we know a little more, if I go back and look at something, I had my u hat was a product. It was a product of f hat with this, e to the minus 4 pi squared s squared t. That should look familiar. This is kind of like the Gaussian thing. The s squared is the Gaussian thing. And in fact, now that we know about convolutions, this is a product of two things. And so now that we know this, we look at this and see, aha, this is the Fourier transform of the Gaussian of x with a certain value of epsilon, where, if you think about it for a while, you'll see epsilon is equal to the square root of 4 pi t. That's going to be fascinating. So this
would be the Fourier transform of a convolution. So we see that u hat of st is the Fourier transform of f convolved with this phi sub epsilon.
And remember, the Fourier transform is a one-to-one onto map of the Schwarz class to itself. And so when I undo that Fourier transform, I see that u can be expressed as a convolution equals f convolved with this thing.
And that thing is called the heat kernel. And let's see, what is it? The phi sub epsilon of x. Remember, my Gaussian was e to the minus pi x over epsilon squared and a 1 over epsilon in front, where my epsilon is the square root of 4 pi t. So this heat kernel is called h sub t of x. And it's 1 over the square root of 4 pi t times e, let's see, what is it going to be? E to the minus x squared over 4t. That's the heat kernel. And the solution to the heat problem is you give me the F and convolve it with this, and it spits out the solution to the heat problem. And the fascinating thing is, let's see, what do we know? That epsilon is square root of 4 pi t. As t goes to 0, that's the Gaussian with a little dinky epsilon. We know that when we convolve the Gaussian with a function, it tends to the function. So here's the big news for today. We know that phi epsilon convolved with f, of course that's the same as f convolved with phi epsilon, tends to f uniformly on the whole real line as epsilon goes to 0. And so the epsilon, remember, is the square root of 4 pi t goes to 0 as t goes to 0. So consequently, if I convolve that heat kernel with f, it tends to f uniformly on the whole real line. So our solution to the heat problem, that was u of xt. It doesn't matter how you write it. It could be f convolved with the heat kernel. Converges to f uniformly as t goes to 0. But that's something we figured out about Gaussians. My Gaussian bump function had that property. So that's nice to know. So then I know that this thing solves the partial differential equation, and now I know that it has the right boundary values in the sense of continuous convergence. That's cool. And so I guess maybe I should write this out once. We have this new formula to look at. U of xt, doesn't matter what order you convolve in, but it'd be an integral from minus infinity to infinity, f of x minus tau. Let's see, I don't like tau. What letter do I like? I guess I like tau. No, let's see, x. I guess I'll use y, a space variable. The y is the variable of integration. And you look at this 1 over the square root of 4t and say, oh my gosh, that's terrible. But look at this. I've got an e to the minus something with a 4t in the denominator. So this thing goes to 0 incredibly fast as t goes to 0 from the right. So this dies away so fast that that square root of t in the denominator has no, has no terrible consequence. It gets wiped out by this thing. Even though this looks like it's a singular kind of integral, it isn't. It's not singular at all.
It doesn't matter that when you approach from the left, it's getting...
We don't approach from... We only care about future
right,
time. Yeah, so time is going positive.
Sure.
If time went negative, then that thing would do bad things. The fact that time is going only into the future is important here. So that's kind of a beautiful formula. And this because of this y squared, this integral dies away incredibly fast in the y variable. And in spite of it, f is in the Schwarz class, so it's going to zero incredibly fast. So it means that if you're going to do numerical computations like an engineer would, you truncate this integral and you can throw away the tail end and get very accurate representation of your solution. Yeah, so that's a nice formula. And now we can understand it from the point of view of Gaussians, and that's how you see that this has the right boundary values. And in fact, this is very much like the Poisson kernel. It's our Gaussian thing, so it's like the Poisson kernel. As time goes to zero, the bump gets more and more concentrated. It gets big, a big bump, but it gets more and more concentrated.
Another thing to note is that not only does my solution tend to, so what we see is not only does u of xt tend to f of x uniformly in x as t goes to zero, but there's a stronger sense that not only that, but the square integral tends to zero. So let's say u of xt minus f of x. So this is in the sense of a square integral, L2 mean, goes to zero as t goes to zero.
So that's kind of a global version of how fast things converge to F. And this is just the Parseval identity. So this is equal to, by Parseval's,
this would be equal to the integral from minus infinity to infinity, the Fourier transform of that thing, and the x variable would be u hat of xt minus f hat. See, it'd be st. We're going to integrate in the s variable. And remember, this thing is, I can pull out the f hat of s. And then what's left, let's see, the u of xt had that e to the minus 4 pi squared s squared t squared in it. T, rather. Minus 1 squared.
And as t goes to 0, let's see, so you'd split this into two integrals. One would be an integral far out.
So this would be equal to an integral where x is bigger than something huge.
And because f is in the Schwarz class, I can make this part as small as I want.
So this part would be small because f is in the Schwarz class. F hat would be in the Schwarz class too. And then I'd have the integral over minus r to r, and that's where I would use the fact that this thing tends to zero uniformly. On compact sets, minus r to r as t goes to zero.
Because e to the 0 is 1, and I'd have 1 minus 1 squared in the limit there. So it goes to 0 uniformly. And that's how you would show that. So now that you know these facts, you can actually use them to show that the Fourier transform method gives you genuine solutions that have the correct boundary values.
And that's true because your S can only be as big as your R, basically?
Yeah, this is an integral in the DS. Okay. And so I'm staying in a compact interval. And so I can make that T go small enough that that would be e to the something really small, which is close to 1.
Right.
On that interval, yeah, if I wanted to write out every Fourier little epsilon and delta, I'd have to think about that. I feel like we don't have a full quorum here today, so I don't want to do anything new. I wanted to start talking about Bessel functions. Have you seen it in another class somewhere, how to solve differential equations by power series methods? You did? What, where? 366 or?
303.
303. What?
We kind of did it in a quantum mechanics class.
Okay.
But it was not rigorous.
It was just one equation.
You were just using, you were just doing it.
The Bessel's equation? Maybe?
No, we did that in waves and oscillations, I think. I don't know.
Okay, so it wouldn't hurt probably to take a look at it more carefully. So I want to solve second order linear ODE via power series. Because I want to introduce the Bessel functions, which are fascinating and useful. So this method will work whenever I would have a of x, y double prime, plus b of x, y prime, plus c of x times y equals 0, where these things have power series expansion. A, B, C are equal to convergent power series. And very often the A, B, and C are going to be polynomials. But there's a danger when you study second order ODEs where the A might vanish. That's a delicate spot. That leads to solutions that go ape very often. So yes, the non-vanishing of the A function is critical. So a danger, nasty spots where the A function might vanish. And it's just an unfortunate fact of life that some of the most important equations in physics and science involve an A that vanishes at the spot we care about, or at one of the spots we care about. It turns out not to be a big deal in the end, but in the beginning, you want to avoid that particular thing. So I thought I would show you by example how you do these things. So let's do, these are called Aries equations. It's y double prime minus x cubed y equals 0. And the power series idea, we don't know yet if we're going to get anything useful out of this, but to try y given by a power series. I could take other center points, but I'm taking center point 0, because it's going to be, that's actually going to be the easiest one to deal with. We don't know if we can get one. We don't know if it's going to converge. We're just going to see what we can get by doing it. Then y prime let's see, would be a sum. Let's see, the first order term would be a constant. So this is a naught plus a1x plus blah, blah, blah. So the first order term is a constant. Its derivative is zero. So this sum actually starts with the a1 term. And let's see, if I differentiate x to the n, I get n a n x to the n minus 1. And so that would be a1 plus 2a2x plus 3a3x squared, etc. And then y double prime would be, let's see, that a1 term is a constant, so it would go away when I differentiate. So this sum starts with the second one. N times n minus 1 a n x to the n minus 2. Let's see, so that would start with 2a2. The next one would be 3 times 2 times a3x. The next one would be 4 times 3 times a4x squared, etc. And now I'm going to plug those in. So I assume that you, did you learn power series someplace that they have a radius of convergence, and on the radius of convergence you can differentiate them term by term. So they're infinitely differentiable. Did you learn that somewhere? 341 maybe? That's a good thing you know. You're in my complex variables class, so we know that you, when the z goes complex, you can differentiate it infinitely times. Then when you restrict to a real line, that's how you would see that. So the best way to do it is to let the variables be complex and use the Cauchy integral formula to understand power series. But if you did a real analysis class, you can understand them without understanding complex variables. Well, now I'm going to plug these power series in the differential equation. So we want y double prime minus x cubed y to be 0. Okay, so y double prime was the sum as n goes from 2 to infinity, n times n minus 1 a n x to the n minus 2. And if I put the x cubed through, this would be a sum as n goes from 0 to infinity a n x to the n plus 3. And we want that to add up to 0. And now if you think about undetermined coefficients, if you think of these as being polynomials, I just gob them together, and the only way a polynomial can add up to 0 is if all the coefficients are 0. All right, so let's think about this. It's kind of a bummer that the powers of x are different. So I think I'm going to shift indices. So here's how I like to think about shifting indices. I'm going to think like change of variables in an integral. For example, in that first sum, I'm thinking of that sum as an integral, and I'm thinking of I'll write a new variable, curly n is equal to n minus 2. Then, of course, square n is equal to curly n plus 2. So this is my curly n. And let's see, at the start, when square n is equal to 2, curly n would be equal to 0. And as square n goes to infinity, curly n goes to infinity. So that first sum, after you get good at this, let's see, this would be a sum as curly n starts at 0 instead of 2, goes to infinity, n is curly n plus 2, n minus 1, let's see, that would be curly n plus 1, a sub n is curly n plus 2, And now I can write x sub curly n here, minus the other one. That's how I like to do shifting indices. One way to do it is to just write it out and say, aha, I see the pattern now. Instead of calling such and such n, I'm going to call the power n, and then I see the pattern. This is always 2 more than that, this is always 1 more than that, and this is always 2 more than that. And it starts at the zeroth power and goes on. So at some point you can start doing it in your head. But the change of variables method means you won't screw it up. And let's see, this other one, I want to shift those indices too. Let's see, when n is equal to 0, that would start for the third power. So let's see, this one is the sum. I want this to be an x to the n. And when I do the shifting indices, let's see, this one is always 3 less. Is it really that? Am I screwing this up? N minus 2. N plus 2. Oh, I know what I'm doing wrong. This is an Aries equation. What is Aries equation? Everybody, physicists, you know what Aries equation is?
No,
I think I do. So here's what I should... I think Aries equation is just this. Is it? I was thinking I was going to do something else today, but I decided not to do it. I'm doing this off the top of my head. Is that Aries equation? Somebody Google Aries equation.
That's right, what you have.
Okay.
After you erased the third power.
Right. Okay, so that is Aries equation. I know a third power is going to come. And let's see, so when I do this, everything's good, good, good. I should fix it right here. Okay, so this would give me a plus 1 here instead of a plus 3, because I'm just multiplying x to the 1. And now when I shift indices in that sum, this would be n, this is 1 less, so this would be n minus 1. And the powers start at the first power and go to infinity. So I just shifted indices in that. And I want this to add up to 0. And now, if these power series converge and are nice, let's see, well, here's an annoying thing. I have this sum starting from 0 and this sum starting from 1. So I better pull out the constant term from that sum. The constant term is 2 times 1 times A2. That's the constant term that, I call that a straggler. A straggler. Constant term from the first one. But then I can jam everything else under one sum, and I might as well turn my curly n back to a square n. So the rest would be a sum from 1 to infinity, and then I'm going to jam them all under 1, and I have n plus 2 times n plus 1 a sub n plus 2 minus a sub n minus 1 times x to the n. And I want that to add up to 0. Well, you know Taylor's formula for if something adds up to 0, these coefficients have all got to be 0, because this is the nth derivative divided by n factorial at 0. So this, by Taylor's formula, is equal to the nth derivative of the function at 0 divided by n factorial. And the function is 0.
And that's going to give me a bunch of equations that A's need to satisfy. And it turns out you can recursively figure them out.
So let's see, you get a recursion formula. And it's called, this happens every time, recursion formula. Let's see, when I solve that, Let's see, the first one is that 2 times A2 equals 0. That's the straggler term. But the actual recursion formula is this. When I solve for AN plus 2 is equal to AN minus 1 over N plus 2 times N plus 1. That's the recursion formula. And it holds for n being 1 onward. Okay, so let's just think about what, let's write these out in the cases and start spitting them out. For n equal 1, this would tell me that A3 equals A0 over 3 times 2. For n equals 2, tells me that A4 is A1 over 4 times 3. And then n equals 3, it's going to tell me I get 0. Let's see, A5 is going to be A2 over 5 times 4, but A2 is equal to 0. Remember, that was the straggler term. So, in fact, every third term is going to be 0. And if you start thinking about this, it should bug you maybe that A0 and A1 do not seem determined. But A0 is the value of y at 0. And A1 is y prime at 0 by Taylor's formula. So and those are the initial conditions. So A0 and A1 are just not going to be pinned down. So these are the initial conditions. And so that's why you don't expect A0 and A1 to get pinned down. But from this point on, I can start pinning these all down. So let's see, n equals 4. This would give me A6 is, go back 3, over 6 times 5. And A3 I already figured out. A3 is A0 over 3 times 2. So this one's A0 over 6 times 5, skip 4, times 3 times 2. I'll do a couple more. A7 is going to be A4 over 7 times 6. And A4 I had above, it's A1 over 4 times 3. So this is going to be A1 over 7 times 6, skip 5, 4 times 3, skip 2. And you'll see the pattern very quickly once you write down a few more of these. And so I write my y like this. My y of x now is the summation of an x to the n. Every other one of those terms, let's see, the next one's going to be 0. Every n equals 6 is going to be 0. A8 is going to be 0. And every third one is 0. Anyway, when you look at this, you'll realize there's A0 terms, and there's going to be A1 terms. And the A0 terms are 1 plus x cubed over 3 times 2 plus x to the 6 over 6 times 5, skip 4, times 3 times 2. These are kind of like, skip 4. These are kind of like factorials with holes in them. And let's see, the next term would be x to the 9th over 9 times 8, skip 7, times 6 times 5, skip 4, times 3 times 2, plus dot, dot, dot. And then the other ones with A1s, they start with the x term. And they would have, let's see, x to the 4th over 4 times 3, plus x to the 7th over 7 times 6, skip 5, times 4, times 3, skip 2, etc. And the mind-blowing thing is that these things converge rapidly. They converge like e to the x. Just like e to the x. In fact, there's lots of holes, so they might even converge faster than e to the x. But those factorials in the denominator make these things converge very rapidly. And in fact, the radius of convergence of this series is infinite. So I claim the radius of convergence is infinite. And that means that we are justified in differentiating these things. And when you differentiate them, they automatically satisfy the recursion formula, which means they satisfy the differential equation. So these really do satisfy the... differential equation. And they're infinitely differentiable. Because once you know the radius of convergence is infinite, you can differentiate them term by term. And the fact that they satisfy the recursion formula means they're going to solve the differential equation. And just here's a cool thing about seeing what the radius of convergence is. Remember the ratio test? Says you take un plus 1 over the un of a series. Well, that's a u far out divided by the u right before it. And these u's were determined by a recursion formula. So let's see, I'll take a u that's far out there. That would be a u, an a n plus 2 times x to the n plus 2. And the one right before it had a power 3 less, so that would be a n minus 1, x to the n minus 1. Right? My first function had only the a naught terms, and those were determined by this recursion formula. So I take one that's far out and I'm dividing by the one right before it. And the recursion formula tells me that ratio is 1 over n plus 2 times n plus 1. That's from the recursion formula. And let's see the powers of n. This would just give me x cubed.
And as n goes to infinity, these go to zero.
And that the ratio test says, therefore, that converges for all x. That zero is less than 1. And what the ratio test says, when that limit exists and is less than 1, this means that the series converges for all x. And those things are called Airy functions. There's two of them. And you know that if a power series has a radius of convergence, it's differentiable infinitely many times. So they're C infinity smooth. And solve the Airy's equation. They actually come up in practice in engineering problems. And they're just as good as the exponential. That's the cool thing. So in fact, you know, you think you live with e to the x every day and know all about it. These are just as good as e to the x. You can write them down. They converge just as rapidly. You can compute them and graph them and make tables of them, whatever you want. They're just as good as e to the x in sine and cosine. Anyway, that's the basic idea of using power series to solve differential equations. And I'll talk more about it next week. Okay. Good week.